Live from the nation's capital, President Joe Biden and comedian Colin Jost headline the White House Correspondents' Dinner. See all the biggest stars together in one room live April 27th at 8 p.m. on CNN and streaming on Max.
Today on Inside Politics, the performance of a lifetime. Hours from now, Joe Biden will deliver what could be the most pivotal speech of his political career. And it's not just the president's job performance that will be under the microscope tonight. It may be his actual performance that matters most. Plus, Donald Trump is calling for debates after boycotting them all primary season. The Biden campaign isn't saying they're in or out, just responding that Trump is, quote, thirsty for attention. And the agonizing choice to leave your home state to terminate a wanted pregnancy. A mother put in that position because of Texas abortion laws will be in the First Lady's box at the State of the Union tonight. But first, Kate Cox is my guest here this hour. I'm Dana Bash. Let's go behind the headlines and inside politics. First up, every moment matters. Every word, every step, every pause, every reaction. For an 81-year-old president who wants four more years in the Oval Office, it all matters, big time. And Joe Biden may never have had a moment like this before and may not again in the next several months at least. Tonight's State of the Union is likely the largest audience the president will have between now and when the voters go to the polls in November. CNN's Kevin Liptak is covering all of the preparations from the White House. Kevin, I want to start with some new reporting on a very thorny foreign policy issue.
Yeah, certainly. This has been the topic that has consumed the president's time over the last several months. And we do understand that in his State of the Union tonight, President Biden plans to make a new announcement when it comes to getting humanitarian aid into Gaza. He will announce that he is directing the U.S. military to undertake an emergency mission to construct a port along the Mediterranean coast in Gaza to allow for the flow of humanitarian aid into the strip. They are likening this to a temporary pier. It will involve aid that's routed through Cyprus on major ships to this pier and into Gaza. And they say this will increase the capacity for aid by hundreds of trucks per day. And very importantly, they say this will not involve U.S. boots on the ground. That is something that President Biden has made very clear that he's not willing to do. They say they are able to construct this port from offshore. And so certainly an important moment for the humanitarian aid, but also politically for President Biden as he's confronting this thorny crisis. So that will be a major announcement. But I think the real centerpiece of this speech tonight will be this focus on economic populism. President Biden calling for higher taxes on the wealthy and corporations, going after corporate greed, talking about lowering costs for health care. Certainly, this is not a new playbook for Democratic presidents running for re-election, but certainly President Biden wants to make clear the contrast with Republicans and the former president, Donald Trump. He'll also talk about protecting freedoms at home and abroad, including calling on the restoration of abortion rights nationwide, talking about the IVF issue. In the First Lady's box, we'll see people affected by that issue. Interestingly, we'll also see the Prime Minister of Sweden. That's the newest member of NATO. President Biden certainly will talk about his commitment to the defense alliance, to Ukraine, all with the eye of providing this contrast with Trump. And certainly those are the main topics he'll talk about. Obviously, the performance will be a main issue for the president as well as he looks to combat those issues on age and fitness. That's why he's been rehearsing over the last several days. Certainly a major moment for the president tonight.
No question. And I should just add to your great reporting, Kevin, that an official Biden administration official adds that he is going to address the war in a, quote, very meaningful way tonight. Kevin, thank you so much for that. As he was just laying out, the president and certainly the candidate part of his job tonight means that he needs to make a very good impression. I want you to just look at this chart. You can see how the president's standing with the American people has changed since his first address to Congress. That happened soon after he took office. His approval ratings are hovering around the lowest of his presidency. I want to bring in my political panel, CNN's David Chalian, CNN's Priscilla Alvarez, and Carl Hulse of The New York Times. I want to start where Kevin started, David, and I want you to talk about sort of the big picture in the moment, but specifically about this decision to make a very big policy announcement when it comes to, first and foremost, what is needed, which is humanitarian aid in the world, but what is needed for him personally, politically, which is a nod to people in his party who are saying, do something, do more.
Well, let's put this in context. President Biden has basically not been able to go give a speech anywhere over the course of the last several months without being shouted down by protesters demanding calls for a ceasefire, demanding calls for more humanitarian aid. This is something that has bedeviled the president, the vice president. You just see it time and time again. So does getting ahead of this a bit, apart from the political piece of it in terms of the electoral politics, does getting ahead of this, putting this out, you know, there could have been a moment, and maybe there still will be, we'll see tonight, with him at the rostrum in the well of the House. You could have had members of Congress, Rashida Tlaib or what have you, sort of embody what all those protesters have been doing to the president as he's been out on the trail. Even in fundraisers, this has been happening. And so this now is trying, I think, to sort of be a release valve a bit of that built up political pressure on this specific issue to give a bit of a policy victory to that side of the equation in hopes of, I think, bringing down the temperature of this moment in the speech.
Jeff Zients, the White House chief of staff, doesn't do a lot of interviews, but he did one with Politico this morning, and he said the following. He said, States of the Union are big moments. You could argue that this is a particularly big moment, and I think there's no one better at handling high stakes than President Biden. You're going to see a very energized president. This is a big moment, and the president rises to those big moments. I think what he's trying to say is this is a big moment.
You have that takeaway.
Just spitballing here. What are you hearing from your sources?
Well, it's not just about the substance, right? It's also about the delivery, right? Because a lot of what we're seeing in the polls is concern about the president's age and his acuity and whether he can have carry on a second term. So it is going to be focused on that as well. But in terms of the substance, I mean, this announcement is significant because there are two things happening at once here. It's not just the administration announcing that they're scaling up aid. They're also tweaking their rhetoric a little bit. Remember, there was a time where we talked about humanitarian pauses. Now the president will go on to say temporary ceasefire. Mm-hmm. The vice president also forceful.
An immediate ceasefire.
Yes. The vice president doing exactly that in Selma on Sunday and talking about the dire situation in Gaza, talking about women, children starving. So there has been shifts here that I think are going to be reflected in his remarks to acknowledge that what voters are feeling and what they're seeing. And that is what I am hearing from my sources. That is what the president has to do. It's also not just talking about what he's accomplished and what his vision is, but understanding the frustration that some voters still have, be it about the costs every day, the kitchen table issues, the concerns about the U.S.-Mexico border, and playing those into his speech.
So let's just pick up on the substance, which is very important. Look at what he is going to talk about, we're told, that he has done, and then what he will do. First, what he has done, the accomplishments that they get frustrated that they don't feel like are penetrating into the electorate. Affordability, strike force to crack down on unfair pricing, to $20 billion reduction in junk fees, affordable student loan repayment plan, forgiving $138 billion in student loans for 3.9 million people, reducing drug prices and so forth. And then when you look prospectively slash, you know, campaign promises, it's all about populism and the idea of punishing corporations, helping the working person, raising the corporate tax rate 28%, raising corporate minimum tax 21%, raising minimum income tax for billionaires 25%, increase Medicare taxes for wealthy. Carl Hulse, you know the mood on Capitol Hill better than most members of Congress. I mean, I'm not suggesting that he thinks that this is going to all pass tomorrow and that this is this is his platform, but is there any desire for
anything?
They're
barely funding the government. Okay. So the Fair idea point. That you're going to do a lot of other things, you know, it's a bit.
I'm laughing. It's actually
it's a bit of
funny.
A pipe.
Yeah.
I mean, you mentioned a kitchen table. This is like the kitchen sink, right? We're going to do all this stuff that we're probably not going to do. And, you know, policy announcements are great in State of the Union. No one really remembers them very long. But what they're going to remember from tonight is how Joe Biden performs. This is one of the State of the Unions where I think people are going to focus on it and see how he does. This is a pretty good setting for Biden. He's very familiar with it as both a senator and a person who sat there as vice president. I think that the Republicans will try and rattle him. Mm-hmm. But the rattling by the Republicans was the best thing about his performance in last year's State of the Union when he got into jousting with them. You know, Joe Biden knows how to counter this kind of thing. But I do think, you know, he really needs to step up. But according to the chief of staff there, they know that this time.
Oh, yeah.
They know that.
They're well aware.
But let's acknowledge what the chief of staff is also doing.
Yeah.
By raising the stakes and leaning into it and describing what a big moment this is and that he needs to deliver and what have you. If Joe Biden doesn't trip on the steps on his way up and gets through the speech, he's going to meet the bar of like of what people are doing in terms of expectation setting here. So I think that the performance is obviously key given everything we're saying, but I think we are we're probably buying into this notion that somehow, as you said, it's a very comfortable setting for him.
It is.
He should be able to deliver a speech,
but it's not
a problem.
Agree. But it's also obviously not just about the speech. It's about the cumulative effect of the feeling of not just apparently some voters, but the people who are in the chattering class, the people who are writing checks. Our colleague Isaac DeVere has some great reporting this morning talking about what he is hearing from Democratic officials. He says 24 top Democratic officials and operatives who spoke to CNN said they're tired of reading that the president is cursing about Donald Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu behind closed doors of the Oval Office, or hearing reports that he told donors that Vladimir Putin is a crazy SOB and that MAGA Republicans are worse than segregationists. They want to see that passion and fire out in public as assurances that the president's behind-the-scenes demeanor doesn't match the public perception of the 81-year-old commander-in-chief wearing thin.
Well, and that is where, yes, this is a very structured setting, the remarks, but it's the off-scripted moments. And that is exactly what Democratic strategists and officials and lawmakers want to see more of. And he did exactly that last year with Social Security. He then followed that up by going to Tampa and basically taking aim at Rick Scott's plan. And those are the moments that people, obviously, people are looking for, but that he also does well in. I mean, he plays that to his advantage in those moments. And it speaks again to whether he can carry the second term, like voters want to see. But this is a place where he can package everything that me and other White House reporters see on the trail in one place, but then also play off what the Republican lawmakers, if they go after him.
Well, and this may be remembered as the abortion rights State of the Union, mm-hmm. too, and with IVF being, I mean, the Democrats are really, really pushing that today. There's a bunch of events leading into this. They see this as a really, really big winner for them in the election, and maybe the issue that could be decisive for Biden as he's trailing a bit.
Okay, up next, because of course he is. Donald Trump promises a, quote, live play-by-play during the State of the Union tonight. A look at what the presumptive GOP nominee will be up to tonight.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number smart beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number smart beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish. There's been a ton of writing about the album Cowboy Carter since it dropped this spring. But what grabbed my attention is a new documentary on CNN called Call Me Country, Beyoncé and Nashville's Renaissance. Lots of artists have tried to boot scoot their way onto country music charts. Why did this album cause such a stir? And what about both this pop star and this political moment has caused all this conversation? Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, on your favorite podcast app.
He won't be at the podium tonight, and he probably won't be mentioned by name, but former President Trump and now the presumptive Republican nominee Donald Trump won't be keeping a low profile during the State of the Union. That's exactly what he is promising. He posted on social media that he will be doing a live play-by-play reaction to the speech and offering quote-unquote corrections. Our panel is back now. David Challian?
Donald Trump is fact checker. Who would have thunk?
His social media platform is called Truth Social.
But listen, it is noteworthy that this State of the Union address comes the day after Nikki Haley gets out of the race, and that the general election begins in earnest, and it is a new context. And obviously, this is a big, huge stage for the president. So you would expect his opponent to try and find a way into the news cycle. Donald Trump doesn't have a hard time finding his way into the news cycle. And so no doubt he will want to inject himself into all the commentary that comes out of the speech in some way. Whatever that may end up being, I think the reality is, and I think the Trump team knows this, this is Joe Biden's night, mm-hmm. which may work for them if indeed his performance is not what mm-hmm. people think it should be.
One of the ways that Donald Trump is trying to make his voice heard, that's I think the way that the Biden campaign put it today, is he's already goading Joe Biden on debates. And he said, and it's important for the good of the country that Joe Biden and I debate issues that are so vital to America and the American people. Therefore, I'm calling for debates anytime, anywhere, any place. The debates cannot be run by the corrupt DNC or their subsidiary, Commission on Presidential Debates. I look forward to receiving a response. This is my favorite part of this. Thank you for your attention to this matter! Exclamation point.
He's still sending out the office memo. People are worried there won't be any debates, and he's saying he'll debate, but who knows? He also says he won't do it with the commission, which is.
I think he actually wants to debate.
Right. I don't know, but
the president's up for it. I mean,
Biden can handle himself in a debate like that. But I think David's right. I think what Trump says will get some attention tonight. But it's hard to break through mm-hmm. the State of the Union, right? It's on all the networks and it's everywhere. And I think the people who've given the sometimes ill-fated response to the State of the Union have found out how difficult that is to counter the president. The scenario is mm-hmm. so big, right?
But isn't it also another way of seeing the hold that the former president holds over the Republican Party? Because there are some things the president could say that would get acknowledgement from Republicans that may not be the case anymore. I mean, I'm just thinking about border security, given my background, but mm-hmm. there are measures in there that he will talk about that there was a time where Republicans would be on board with it.
He'll get mad at them if they clap at anything that he says.
Right.
That's a really good
support
point.
Support for NATO and
exactly.
The Ukraine matter is another area that
I doubt
Biden will draw the contrast.
A divide. So let's just shift gears slightly and talk a bit more about what Donald Trump has to do, if he tries to do it, to get those Nikki Haley voters back in his fold, looking ahead. One of the questions is about how the voters feel and whether or not those who voted for Nikki Haley were just trying to protest and then they'll come back into the fold, or whether they protested and they're like, never going to do it. Our colleagues went out and talked to some of those Haley voters in Virginia. They voted on Super Tuesday. Let's listen.
No question, Biden. We cannot have another 4 years of that man.
I'm not going to vote for either one. If she was on the no-labels ticket, I would certainly vote for her.
So my intention is to write her in at the end, and because I really cannot vote for her opponent.
I, at this point, can't answer that question. I think that this country can do better than the choice that we've been given.
Which leads me to a question that is more relevant than we have seen in many, many cycles, I think since you and I really have been covering campaigns, and that is whether there is really a fertile ground for a third way. And Liz Cheney sent out this tweet. She said the GOP has chosen. They will nominate a man who attempted to overturn an election and seize power. We have 8 months to save our republic and ensure Donald Trump's never anywhere near the Oval Office again. Join me in the fight for our nation's freedom. I'm not suggesting that she is going to jump in and be that third way. others are, but it's people like that who have megaphones, who don't want either candidate necessarily, who are trying to figure out what to do with this frustrated sector.
Yeah, on Liz Cheney specifically, I mean, watch this space, because she doesn't want Donald Trump.
Exactly.
That's what she really doesn't want.
Yeah.
And if she thinks the best way to not get Donald Trump is supporting Joe Biden, I would imagine you might see her on the convention stage in Chicago at a Biden convention.
So there's that dynamic, and then the other voters.
Exactly. Yeah. And there's no doubt, Dana, that voters, I mean, you just heard some of them, would like an out here and like find a viable third party. And it's always been an attractive option. The issue is, of course, there's not a path really for that kind of candidate in our system to get to 270 electoral votes. I mean, you know, Ross Perot got 19% of the vote. He got zero electoral votes. So it is so difficult. And what it does, and this is why Democrats are so worried about this, the entrance of giving that option to people who don't want Biden and really don't want Trump, it lowers Trump's need number, his win number. It lowers it and makes Trump winning more attainable. That's what Democrats are going to try to convince the folks that are around No Labels or people who may go support Robert F. Kennedy Jr. that they are handing the Oval Office to Donald Trump.
Real quick, Carl.
I mean, the cards are stacked against a third party person. What those people are, what this election is about. How do you get those people?
Yep.
And that's what Biden's going to have to try to do. I have a hard time seeing Trump getting those people. But another alternative could get their vote and make them feel better when they vote.
And Biden tried real quick to get them, too.
Yeah, he did. All right, up next, border security will be a big issue inside the Capitol tonight, just as it is on the campaign trail ahead. A really interesting look from the CNN K-File at how President Biden has evolved on the issue. President Biden is just hours away from delivering his last State of the Union address before the election, and the border crisis will no doubt be center stage, just as it has been on the campaign trail. Our K-File team did some digging and found Biden is now talking about immigration really differently than he did in his 2020 presidential campaign, where he called the migrants seeking asylum, called on migrants seeking asylum to surge the border, easy for me to say. Listen to what Biden said during an Iowa campaign stop back in 2019.
We could afford to take in a heartbeat another 2 million people. The idea that a country of 330 million people cannot absorb people who are in desperate need and who are justifiably fleeing oppression is absolutely bizarre. Absolutely bizarre. I would also move to increase the total number of immigrants able to come to the United States.
Joining me now is CNN's Andrew Kaczynski. Andrew, we have seen far more than that when we're looking at the number of people crossing the border since he became president.
Well, that's right. Biden's own administration points to these numbers, more than 3 million migrants who entered since Biden took office who are still in the country. And as you know, mass migration at the border is significantly overwhelming U.S. immigration resources. The president is now grappling with the reality of one of the worst immigration crises in decades as he campaigns for re-election. We've all seen how Biden is reacting to this. He is toughening up his language and his policies. Recently, the White House shifted its rhetoric on sanctuary cities. They're now urging those cities to comply with law enforcement agencies regarding migrants who committed a crime. And he traveled to the border last week, where he called that bipartisan Senate bill, which was killed by Republicans, the toughest that the country has ever seen. Take a listen to this.
They desperately need more resources. Say it again, they desperately need more resources, need more agents, more officers, more judges, more equipment in order to secure our border. Folks, it's time for us to move on this. We can't wait any longer.
The interesting thing, Andrew, is that this shift in language is him going back to a position that he held when he was senator and he was vice president.
Well, that's right. Before he got significantly more progressive in that campaign for president, he held much tougher views, so much stronger as a senator, where he supported building barriers at the border, not allowing sanctuary cities to violate federal immigration law, and he even wanted to crack down on employers who hired undocumented immigrants. Now, you do have to go all the way back to 2006 and 2007, but listen to what Biden said at two separate campaign events those years.
Folks, I voted for a fence. I voted, unlike most Democrats, and some of you won't like it, I voted for 700-mile fence. But let me tell you, we can build a fence 40 stories high unless it changes the dynamic in Mexico. And you will not like this, and punish American employers who knowingly violate the law when in fact they hire illegals. Unless you do those two things, all the rest is window dressing.
No great country can say it is secure without being able to control its borders. I would radically ramp up the number of border security guards we have.
So in a statement to CNN, the White House told us that on the first day of his administration, President Biden has called on Congress to pass comprehensive immigration reform. We need to make significant policy reforms and to provide additional funding to secure our border and fix our broken immigration system. So that was Biden then. Dana, this is him now, and it's going to be interesting to see how all of this plays out in this presidential campaign.
And it's remarkable to see the kind of twists and turns of the Biden position that really go hand in hand with the twists and turns of what's happening on the border and with the politics of immigration over the last decade and a half. Thank you so much, Andrew. Appreciate it. And President Biden is getting some advice ahead of his big speech tonight from a few people who've done the job before. Well, at least they did so on screen.
I can tell you without hesitation, being president of this country is entirely about character.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
In my capacity as president, all I had to deal with was a meteor. One of the things that I came out of that with in my speech to people, hope. Hope is the strongest force we have in this country.
Looking back at my own presidency, I behaved very badly in a lot of situations.
I had it easy. You know, we just had invaders from outer space coming in wanting to mess with us, and that tends to unify people.
Love and compassion as a leader are strengths. They're not weaknesses, and are key to your character. So let that shine through in your speech. And don't forget to save a dance for the First Lady in the East Room.
Our next guest doesn't have the presidential experience of those actors, but he does have some experience getting elected to Congress as a Democrat in a swing district in a very tough year this year. I'm talking about Congressman Tom Suozzi, the newest House Democrat, sworn in just last week after winning an election to replace George Santos.
Thank I love you so those much. Movies. Those
they,
are
I know,
movies.
They are. They really are. They make you feel good. You are a Democrat in the chamber who I don't think there's anybody who has faced voters more recently than you. And given that experience from a battleground district, what does the president need to do tonight to reach the kind of voters who you reached in your election?
I think the president's starting to do what he needs to do, which is he hears the voters, what they're concerned about, and talk about the things that the voters are concerned about. So the voters are concerned about the border, and the president just went down to the border. I thought that was a very smart move on his part. Voters are concerned about the cost of living. I think he's going to talk about the cost of living tonight. Voters are concerned about the future. He's going to not just talk about all of his great accomplishments. He's going to talk about his vision for the future as
on,
well.
On the border, because you turn that on its head, if you will, politically, which is part of the reason I think you agree that you won and you won so resoundingly last month. Does he need to just talk, or is there something that you would like him to do, given the gridlock in Congress, using his executive power?
I think that the most important thing the president has to do is say that I am willing to compromise. I'm willing to do a bipartisan compromise. I'm not going to get everything I want the way I want it, but I'm willing to be flexible to try and solve this very real problem that exists. And when he does that, if the Republicans go along with him, then we can finally move the country forward after having faced this issue for 35 years with no solution. If they don't go along with him, the president can say very clearly, hey, are you guys just playing politics? Are you just trying to weaponize this issue for political purposes? So I think he started to do that when he went down to the border. He said, listen, Trump, you tell me what ideas you have. Because President Trump and the Republicans, and my opponent in my race, said, it's a problem. Say, okay, well, what do you want to do? Well, it's a problem. It's a really big problem.
Well, they want to remain in Mexico, for example. That is something that is a very specific idea that they want. Would that be that you would support?
I would support it if it was part of an overall compromise. You know, the compromise that exists at center, you can't find a more conservative, intelligent, ethical Republican than James Lankford. And he proposed a bipartisan compromise that said more border agents, more wall, more detention beds, more immigration judges, money for New York and New York City and other places throughout the country. Very reasonable solution. And the Republicans said, no, we don't want to give Biden a victory.
Okay, so this is Inside Politics. Let's talk politics for a minute or two. We are now in the general election, the 2024 general election. You have questioned whether President Biden would still be the Democratic nominee. He really appears to be. There's nobody who's running against him anymore. Are you ready to support him now in November?
Absolutely. I mean, the president, the race has just joined now. We just had Super Tuesday. What's today? Thursday, 2 days ago. And so I think people are going to start paying attention. The president has to perform tonight because the big issue about the president is his age. He can't change his age. He is his age. That's an objective fact. If he performs tonight and people see him perform, they're going to say, wow, he's doing pretty well.
Okay. In New York, the governor, your governor, signed a new congressional map into law last week. It was drawn by the Democratic-controlled legislature. It gave Democrats, including you, a little bit of a boost in the fall, given where the lines are. Isn't protecting incumbents, whether it's Democrats or Republicans, what is wrong with Congress, why it makes it so hard to work because of the gerrymandering?
Absolutely, 100%. I don't get it.
Aren't you being gerrymandered?
It's very, very slight. In fact, the little improvement to my district resulted in two Republican districts getting better. Mm-hmm. So that's why why there was a compromise with Democrats.
Incumbent protection.
But there were Democrats and Republicans who negotiated this in New York State. I don't get involved in that stuff. Mm-hmm. I didn't pay attention at all. Whatever the district is, I'll take the district, whatever it is. But you are right that the biggest problem in our country is that so many seats are safe seats. And as a result, you don't have to talk to the people and you just talk to the base, because that's who votes in the primaries. And that's what's killing our country. Because when Democrats just talk to the far left and Republicans just talk to the far right, that's what's killing our country. The people in the middle are the ones left behind.
Okay, I'm pretty much obsessed with this topic. So thank you for mentioning it, and come back because I want to talk more about it.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks
so
for
much.
Coming on. Congratulations again.
Thank you.
And sitting with the First Lady at the State of the Union will be a Texas woman who sued her state for the right to an abortion.
The first thing we saw was a very clear issue development of the spine. And so we thought, well, maybe our baby will have a life in a wheelchair, you know. And then the next week we saw more, and that continued over 5 weeks. And that's when we got the full diagnosis, and that final ultrasound was like catastrophic. It was, our baby would never survive.
House Speaker Mike Johnson is calling IVF a great technology. But in an interview this morning with CBS, he sidestepped a question about whether an embryo has the same rights as a child.
If you believe life begins at conception, fertilization, and I know you do, do you see that as murder? It's something that we've got to grapple with. We support the sanctity of life, of course, and we support IVF and the full access to it. We know lots of families, friends of ours, who have beautiful families because of that. Alabama, I think, has a good example of that. It's something that every state has to wrestle with, and I think Alabama's done a good job of hitting it head on early on.
Johnson's remarks come ahead of the State of the Union tonight, where reproductive rights will be a focal point. Among those on the guest list from the White House, an Alabama woman who was in the process of IVF treatment until a recent state Supreme Court decision there, and also Kate Cox, the Texas mother who waged a legal battle with her state 3 months ago over her right to have an abortion. I sat down with Kate and her husband, Justin, whose emotions are still understandably raw. How many weeks pregnant were you when you first heard trisomy 18 and that you're at risk for your baby having that, which is a rare chromosomal disorder?
I think I was around 13 weeks when it first came up as a risk. The first thing we saw was a very clear issue with development of the spine. And so we thought, well, maybe our baby will have a life in a wheelchair, you know. And then the next week we saw more, and that continued over 5 weeks. And that's when we got the full diagnosis, and that final ultrasound was like catastrophic. It was, our baby would never survive.
The moment as a parent, as a mother, when you learn that there's something wrong with your pregnancy, I know what that's like. And it's etched in your memory forever.
Mm-hmm. I asked the doctor, best case scenario, if she survived the pregnancy, because the full trisomy 18 babies often miscarry or are stillborn. And so if we survived the pregnancy and we survived the birth, how long, best case scenario, did she think we could have with her? And she said the longest would be a week. I asked my doctor, what do women do when they receive a diagnosis like that, like this? And she told me some women choose to continue the pregnancy and some choose not to. And I asked her if that was an option in Texas, if I chose not to do the pregnancy, and she told me it was not.
So you filed a lawsuit, and the court granted the restraining order on the law saying that you could legally obtain an abortion and that you would not be at risk for driving your wife, that the doctor would not be at risk. But then the next day, the Texas Supreme Court temporarily blocked the decision. What were those days like?
Well, when we got the ruling from the judge, we were excited and hopeful. We thought, wow, you know, maybe everybody will see the, you know, common sense that comes with this issue like we do, that this is medical care, this is what's needed, going from hopeful to feeling like, okay, this isn't going to be as easy as we thought.
It was really crushing. Pregnancies are complicated, and it's difficult sometimes to build your family, so it's really terrifying when that's left up to politicians and judges.
You did make the decision to travel outside of Texas. You went to New Mexico to have an abortion. Mm-hmm. Tough decision.
Yeah. We were on a strict timeline, and we couldn't wait any longer, so the decision had to be made.
It's the hardest thing we've ever been through in our lives. And the laws today added a lot more pain to what was already the most painful time in our lives. That's why I want to share our story, and that's why I hope it'll be different one day.
Yeah. Abortion has always been a very political issue, even more so since Roe was overturned. Were you a particularly political couple, or were you a political person before this?
Not at all. I was not a political person.
We both have voted in the past, but we've never been very enthusiastic about the process.
And you are now?
Yes. We certainly are now.
Yeah. I'm guessing you're going to vote for Joe Biden?
The number one thing we're both voting for is protection of abortion rights, because women and families deserve medical care. This, I don't want to see others continue to be hurt. How many women have to tell their most heartbreaking journey publicly? How many have to speak out before something changes?
In 2012, I was covering the Santorum campaign, Rick Santorum's presidential campaign.
And I remember not long before that, they had a little girl, Bella, with trisomy 18. Mm-hmm. And she survived, and she's mm-hmm. now a teenager. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you saw that he posted something and wanted you all and people with mm-hmm. those circumstances to see Bella's story.
I love to see Bella's story. She's absolutely beautiful. I'm so happy for their family. Not every pregnancy and every case of trisomy 18 is the same. Our baby's circumstances, she would never survive. That wasn't the case for us. And at the end of the day, he made the decision for his family, and we made the decision for our family.
You are here because you are going to be guests of the First Lady in the First Lady's box at the President's State of the Union address. What was it like getting a call from the White House?
It was an incredible honor. I'm so grateful to Dr. Biden and President Biden for shining a light on this important issue. In true mom fashion, actually, I was chasing kids, and so I missed the call. And when I looked, I saw that caller ID said I had missed a call, and caller ID showed Joseph Biden. So I didn't think it was real. And I said, Grandma, we need you. Gotta watch the kids. I gotta have this phone call. And you said some really kind words. I'm grateful to share our story, and I hope others can learn from what we went through as well.
Thank you to Justin and Kate for sharing their story with us. And a quick reminder, join CNN for special live coverage of the State of the Union address tonight at 8 p.m. Eastern or stream on CNN Max. Thank you so much for joining Inside Politics. CNN News Central starts after the break.
You can now watch CNN's Five Things on Max. Each weekday, Kate Baldwin breaks down the five essential news stories in 5 minutes or less. She'll get you up to speed and on with your day. CNN's Five Things with Kate Baldwin, streaming weekdays exclusively on Max.